Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso. Today we open our show with some national news from Public News Service, including an update on Hurricane Maria, safety questions raised after nursing home deaths after Hurricane Irma, and the latest on North Korea's nuclear threats. In our local government report, hear why La Mesa's City Council reversed its earlier decision and approved a controversial apartment development. Plus, hear about new controversies involving El Cajon Councilman Ben Colasso, including an inquiry from the State Attorney General over the nonprofit status of a beauty pageant that he's run. Hear why California now has the highest poverty rate in the nation. And then, hear tips from San Diego's district attorney on how to protect your personal information after the Equifax Credit Bureau hack. Find out what it was like for participants at the first annual Ramona Grape Stomp. And then on the second half of our show today, our newsmaker interview is with Tim Nader, a candidate for Superior Court Judge. He's held several public offices as well as working for the State Attorney General, and now he's running against a sitting judge who was recently censured for judicial misconduct. And finally, hear why an artist's mural along the border fence in East County is drawing national attention. Stay tuned for all of these stories on today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters.
Welcome to the Public News Service Daily Newscast for Monday, September 18, 2017. I'm Mary Sherman. We're following several stories from around the globe, including Hurricane Maria targets Irma-damaged areas, nursing home deaths spotlight weakened laws to protect the elderly, and the U.S. might be out of diplomatic options in addressing North Korea's nuclear threat. At the top of the list, Caribbean islands devastated less than 2 weeks ago by Hurricane Irma are now in the path of Hurricane Maria, which strengthened into a Category 1 Sunday afternoon. Maria could dump 6 to 12 inches of rain across the Leeward Islands, including Puerto Rico, the U.S. Virgin Islands, and the British Virgin Islands through Wednesday night. Early models indicate the storm will move toward Florida and up the East Coast, but so far in advance, forecasters could be hundreds of miles off. Meanwhile, Hurricane Jose moved north Sunday, threatening dangerous surf and rip currents along the U.S. East Coast in the next few days. While the storm's forecast to stay offshore, it could cause impacts from Virginia to New England. Advocates for people with disabilities say the death of 8 residents of a Florida nursing home that lost power shows the importance of better planning to help those with special needs during emergencies. Andrea Sears has the story.
Seniors and people with disabilities face disproportionately increased risks of injury and death when storms, floods, and other emergencies hit. Susan Dua, executive director of the Center for Independence of the Disabled in New York, says without proper planning, things can go horribly wrong.
We've seen people turned away at shelters, lack of effective interpretation for people who are deaf, people trapped watching the water rise around them.
In the wake of Hurricane Sandy, a federal judge ordered New York City's Office of Emergency Management to implement changes necessary to accommodate people with disabilities.
U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Nikki Haley said Sunday the U.N. Security Council has run out of options on containing North Korea's nuclear program, and the U.S. may have to turn the matter over to the Pentagon. As world leaders head to the U.N. headquarters in New York for the annual General Assembly this week, Haley's comments indicated the United States was not backing down from its threat of military action against North Korea. On Thursday, North Korea launched a missile over Japan into the Pacific Ocean in defiance of new UN Security Council sanctions banning its textile imports and capping imports of crude oil. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson said Sunday that the United States is considering closing the U.S. Embassy in Havana in response to mysterious hearing problems that have left at least 21 employees with serious health issues. Closing the U.S. embassy in Cuba would be a serious setback to relations between the countries, whose disputes stretch more than a half century before they restored diplomatic relations and upgraded their missions into embassies in 2015. Back here in the U.S., the prison population is declining in most states, but not in New Mexico, and that's creating problems for elected officials.
A privately run for-profit prison in Torrance County announced it would close at the end of this week because it doesn't have enough inmates. At the same time, the latest prison population report shows that from 2012 to 2016, the number of men held in state prison rose by more than 9%, and the number of women inmates increased by more than 22%. New Mexico attorney Mark Donatelli says saving money was one reason the government turned to private prisons, but he worries that the Trump administration's increased detention and criminal prosecution of immigrants could also benefit private prisons.
We still have the highest percentage of our state correctional system in a private provider hand, in part to reduce costs, but it was also to play the government game of giving contracts to donors.
In July, CoreCivic, a company that has operated the private prison in Estancia for nearly 3 decades, announced it would close the Torrance County detention facility by Friday. I'm Roz Brown.
At a time when people across the country are calling for removal of Confederate statues and artwork because they're seen as divisive, a petition drives underway to remove a controversial painting at the Indiana University Bloomington campus. Students taking classes at Woodbury Hall see a large mural depicting Hoosier history. In the background is the scene of a Ku Klux Klan rally, complete with hooded men and a burning cross. Former IU lecturer and assistant professor Lanier Holt says Indiana is known for a lot of things, including race cars and basketball. And he says it's unfortunate that IU decided to highlight something that's so insidious.
Why should we hang something that pure and simple not just acknowledges, but sort of normalizes the glorification of an organization who's bent on the destruction of Jews, gays, blacks, and anyone that's not white, Anglo-Saxon, Protestant?
IU says there are no plans to remove the painting, with officials stating it celebrates the downfall of the KKK, which is deeply embedded in Indiana's history. As folks enjoy the late summer crops produced in this country and around the world, advocates are hoping everyone will take time to appreciate the little creatures that pollinated them.
About three-quarters of the more than 240,000 species of the world's flowering plants rely on pollinators, which includes bees, birds, bats, and other animals. Tiffany Fink-Haynes with Friends of the Earth says not only should pollinators be acknowledged for the role they play in agriculture, but the peril therein needs to be recognized as well.
Bees are responsible for 1 in every 3 bites of food we eat. And they're also an indicator species. So if bees and other pollinators are declining at such alarming rates, it's telling us that there's something more serious going on in our environment, and we're seeing wider spread contamination that's going to create a problem for us.
Bee decline is being blamed on habitat loss, parasites, and pesticide use. I'm Veronica Carter reporting.
And I'm Mary Sherman for Public News Service, member and listener supported, and online at publicnewsservice.org.
This is Gene Carpenter with a local government report in La Mesa. La Mesa's city council has reversed an earlier deadlock and voted to approve Silvergate's 130-unit apartment development at the site of the former Little Flower Haven Convent on La Mesa Boulevard. The vote was 4-0, with Councilman Colin Parent recused because he lives near the project. The development sparked mass opposition from neighbors, primarily due to concerns over parking. The developer qualified for a state-mandated density bonus, meaning he could reduce parking spaces from 260 normally required by city ordinances down to just 193 spaces in exchange for providing affordable housing in 10% of the units. After the earlier deadlock, the developer threatened to sue the city unless it approved the project. City Council insisted their hands were tied and that they risked jail time if they didn't approve the development. Mayor Mark Arapostathis, in switching his August no vote, said, "The law is flawed." The mayor told the public that if the city went to court, it would lose and be ordered to pay attorney fees. He said he asked what would happen if the city refused to pay and was told that individual council members would be held in contempt of court. Councilman Guy McWhirter said, "I can't go against the state. I can't go against the law," adding, "I'll argue and I'll fight, but I'm not going to go to jail for this." Public speakers called the developer a bully, but also received assurances from Silvergate Representative Ian Gill that the tenant leases would include clauses that exclude parking in the Porter Hill neighborhood, which has lots of narrow streets and one-car garages. Councilman Bill Baber wanted this parking clause added into the agreement, but City Attorney Glenn Sabine said, "I think that's between the parties to rely on good faith." One disgruntled La Mesa resident called the council's approval a dereliction of leadership, adding, "They should take the lead to organize with other jurisdictions to get state laws changed." Council also discussed the future of the Design Review Board, which had recommended approval of the Silvergate project by a 3-2 vote. The yes votes came from two city staff members on the board and a third member who had worked for the developer doing architectural work just 16 months prior to the vote. The city attorney said there is no way to strengthen the city's conflict of interest rule since state law limits that only to board members who worked for a developer within the past 12 months. Staff will bring two proposals back to the council, one to eliminate the design review board and transfer its design review process to the planning commission, and another to eliminate as voting members of the design review board La Mesa City staff. Most public comments were in support of keeping the design review board but removing city staff as voting members.
This is Miriam Raftery with a report from El Cajon on the latest controversy involving El Cajon Councilman Ben Colosio. California Attorney General Javier Becerra has sent Colosio a letter of inquiry probing the Miss Middle East beauty pageant USA that was long run by Colosio. Nonprofits must account for where donations come from and how funds are spent. The Attorney General's letter suggests that Colosio failed to file proper paperwork to receive designation as a nonprofit organization for that pageant. The pageant was run for several years by the San Diego East County Chaldean Chamber of Commerce, also founded by Colosio, but the pageant may be subject to, quote, registration and reporting requirements, the Attorney General's letter states. He has ordered Colosio to provide copies of documents including a registration form, bylaws, an Internal Revenue Service determination letter, and a copy of the application of recognition of exemption within 30 days. Now, the chamber was briefly incorporated with the California Secretary of State as a nonprofit, but in November 2013, the chamber's nonprofit status was suspended. Colosio has indicated he never completed the paperwork and told both East County Magazine and the San Diego Union-Tribune that he operated the chamber as a sole proprietorship instead. The trade group represented Chaldean small businesses in El Cajon before it was suspended by the California Franchise Tax Board last year. In June, the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office issued an order canceling Colosio's trademark for the San Diego East County Chaldean American Chamber of Commerce name due to confusion with the Chaldean American Chamber of Commerce group based in Detroit, which has been using its name since 2001 and recently sued Colosio over the issue. Colosio has since taken the name off his chamber site and launched a new organization, the Middle Eastern Chamber of Commerce, which he told the Union Tribune is the largest ethnic chamber in the world. He has not disclosed its members. However, the U.S. Hispanic Chamber of Commerce claims to represent over 4.2 million Hispanic business owners, and many other ethnic chambers also tout very large memberships at a national level. The State Franchise Tax Board says that although the San Diego East County Chaldean American Chamber was suspended on June 1, 2016 for failing to pay fees, it remained registered on the state's books at the time of the suspension. That Colosio had not formally terminated the nonprofit could end up harming local businesses and individuals who may have claimed membership fees as a tax deduction on their federal tax forms, according to Miranda Fleischer, a University of San Diego law professor who teaches taxation subjects at its School of Law. She says that an organization has a tax-exempt status with the state does not mean that it has a tax-exempt status with federal law that gives individuals the ability to take a federal deduction when they make a donation. She says that when a nonprofit is formed under state law, a group has 27 months to file for federal tax exemption, which would make donations to the organization tax-deductible. But if no application to the federal government was filed, or if the application was rejected, she advises, the people who made a contribution shouldn't have been able to take a tax deduction for that year. If they did that, they essentially underpaid their taxes. One of the major corporate contributors to Colosio's chamber has been Waste Management, which operates waste disposal franchises throughout the U.S. and in the city of El Cajon. Waste Management had contributed $2,500 to the chamber. Waste Management's senior communications manager, Eloise Orozco, told us, like a good and responsible member of the community, we contribute to many organizations so we can effectively reach out to them. But she confirmed, Waste Management has sent a letter to Colosio withdrawing its membership of the chamber. Orozco said, Whether Waste Management will request the money it has contributed to be returned is too early to tell, but she adds, we have taken the steps we have because we're not entirely comfortable contributing to an organization which is involved in a controversy. Now, Colosio is also facing civil suits filed by beauty pageant contestants, including claims that the pageant was fraudulent and claims of sexual harassment, including one contestant who has accused Colosio of offering to trade sex for the crown. Colosio has denied all of those allegations and filed a countersuit. Another potential issue for Colosio is that he recently participated in an El Cajon City Council vote on liens against property owners who did not pay bills to Waste Management, which contracts with the city to provide trash pickup services. Council members are supposed to recuse themselves from votes to avoid conflicts of interest, and it's unclear why Colosio didn't recuse himself since his organization received substantial funding from Waste Management. East County Magazine reached out to Colosio for comment, but he did not offer a response. He has dodged our reporters' and editors' efforts to obtain comments for multiple recent stories on his various controversies. The San Diego Union-Tribune reports that in response to a series of tough questions sent to Colosio by the Union-Tribune reporter Jeff McDonald, Councilman Colosio called McDonald a troll repeatedly and said he merited a Worst Journalist Award. Colosio also threatened to sue the Union-Tribune's award-winning journalist, claiming that Waste Management never withdrew its support from his chamber, as McDonald reported. However, Waste Management also confirmed its withdrawal of support to East County Magazine reporter Paul Cruz, both over the telephone and in an email. McDonald responded to Colosio's tirade calmly, stating in an email back, I hope you reconsider this reply and deal with the questions I posed rather than insult my motivation or professionalism. The exchange prompted the Union Tribune's editorial board to publish its own editorial, which concludes, declining comment in politics is one thing, but dripping contempt is something else. Colosio should dial it back. El Cajon's constituents are poorly served by his lack of professionalism, the Union Tribune concluded.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea. Public interest news for our region.
Stubborn poverty continues to plague the Golden State, which maintains the worst poverty rate in the nation, with 14.3% of residents and almost 20% of children living below the federal poverty line. However, the new census numbers on poverty do show that the state is a bit better off than last year. The state's median annual household income of $67,000 is about $10,000 higher than the national average, but that money doesn't go very far because the median price we pay for a home is more than twice the national average. Jessica Bartolo with the Western Center on Law and Poverty says the cost of living here is a huge problem.
With high rent prices, low vacancy rate on rental housing, you're starting to see that really hit our supplemental poverty rate. And we know that the lack of affordable housing is the number one reason why we are in this spot that we're in now.
California's supplemental poverty rate, which takes the cost of living into account, is above the national average. San Francisco has the highest median income in the nation at more than $97,000, but the state also has a very large gap between rich and poor. The state legislative session ends tonight at midnight, and lawmakers are still working on a package of housing bills that would create more affordable units and prevent rents from spiking. Bartolo says a lot also depends on the federal budget and the GOP push to repeal Obamacare and slash Medi-Cal.
We're hoping that the federal government takes heed of these good numbers and doesn't make drastic changes to either the economy impacting low-income workers or the safety net.
Anti-poverty groups also support bills that reduce fines and fees in the criminal justice system that would prevent debt collectors from using bank levies to wipe out people's last dollar. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
This is a public service announcement from the San Diego District Attorney's Office. Consumers should take steps to protect your personal information from identity theft in the wake of a recent data breach at Equifax, one of the large credit bureaus in the United States. Cyber criminals stole 143 million credit records in the recent hacking scandal. District Attorney Summer Steffen says, at this point, millions of consumers have to assume that the bad guys have highly personal information that they can use to trick you. Here's what you should watch out for. Phishing scams or phony emails that claim to be from Equifax, where you can check if your data was compromised. Phishing emails that claim there is a problem with a credit card, your credit record, or other personal financial information. Calls from scammers that claim they are from your bank or credit union. Fraudulent charges on any credit card because your identity was stolen. Here are four things you can do to prevent identity theft. Sign up for credit monitoring. There are many companies providing that service, including Equifax, but be sure to read the terms of agreement carefully and note if there are any setup or recurring costs associated with the monitoring. Place a fraud alert with one of the major credit bureaus, Equifax, Experian, and TransUnion. Placing a fraud alert is free and stays on your credit report for 90 days. Check your credit reports for free at annualcreditreport.com. Check your bank and credit card statements for any unauthorized activity. If you believe you may have been the victim of identity theft, you can learn more about how to protect yourself at idtheftcenter.org and the Federal Trade Commission's Consumer Information on Identity Theft webpage. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Gene Carpenter.
Those were the sounds of the first annual Ramona Grape Stomping Competition, where teams of competitors vied to see who could crush the most grapes in 2 minutes and emerge champion. Teams chose names such as the Juicy Lucys or the Toe Jammers. One team member stomped the ripe purple grapes and the other filled a cup with juice spurting out of a spigot on a wine barrel. A grape stomp princess was also on hand to help officiate as the contestants hopped in feet first, demonstrating their stomping skills on stage as an audience cheered them on with gusto. Less competitive-spirited folks could also stomp just for fun and pose for photos at a separate stomping area. Terry Kearns from the Ramona Ranch Winery and Vineyards told us, "We're excited to see the wineries coming together to give back to our community." Hosted by the Ramona Valley Vineyards Association, Ramona Rotary Club, and Ramona Senior Center, the event benefited local community projects, including college scholarships, a senior nutrition program, the Ramona Boys and Girls Club, 4th of July fireworks, and education on this fast-growing wine region. Crowds flocked to the Ramona Outdoor Community Center Pavilion, where the activities included wine tasting from many local wineries serving up locally produced vintages, many from award-winning local vintners. Guests could enjoy foods, bid on silent auction prizes such as wine baskets and handmade Adirondack chairs, try their luck on raffle items, and shop from vendors offering everything from Western ware to wine-themed accessories such as blown glass wine stoppers and serving trays made from old wine bottles. If you missed this year's Ramona Grape Stomp, no worries. Organizers have promised to make this successful stomp an annual event, so you can come back next year and many times more in the future to stomp, shop, and sip to your heart's content. Reporting for East County Magazine from Ramona, this is Miriam Raftery.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
The East County Magazine Show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Now stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show. Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice. And today, my very special guest is Tim Nader. He is a candidate for the San Diego Superior Court. He would bring to the bench decades of high-level legal experience as well as experience as a leader in education and government.
Tim, welcome to the show.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Can you start by telling our listeners a little bit about yourself and your background?
Sure. I have lived here in San Diego County and mostly in the South Bay for most of my life. I grew up in Chula Vista, where I currently reside. Went away to Northern California to go to college and law school. And then after returning with my law degree, I took a job with the State Court of Appeal, where I worked as a research attorney for 2 years before I was hired by the State Attorney General. Mm-hmm. Worked in the criminal division of the State Attorney General's office, doing mostly appellate-level prosecution for about 7 years.
Very good experience.
And then I was elected mayor of Chula Vista in 1991 after I had previously been elected twice to the city council.
Yeah.
But in Chula Vista, the city council's part-time, but the mayor is full-time. So at that point, I left the AG's office and worked as the full-time mayor of Chula Vista through 1994. Following my departure from the mayor's office, I worked for several years as a nonprofit executive director in the affordable housing and social services arena.
Yeah, you were an executive director, I understand.
I was executive director of two different nonprofits, one here and one in Colorado. And then in 2002, I returned to the full-time practice of law, working as a child support attorney for the County of San Diego before I was rehired by the State Attorney General, where I currently work in the civil division.
So you've had civil, criminal, and family law experience, a pretty broad background for a judicial candidate.
That's right.
On your website, you've said that you are qualified, fair, independent, and listen to the facts, and that at a time when our society seems more polarized than ever, and some seem carried away with groundless conspiracy theories and accusations, we need more than ever to have judges who are independent and fact-oriented. Your opponent, Judge Gary Kriep, has a rather interesting record. Listeners, if you're not familiar with the controversies over Judge Kriep, he was actually publicly censured in August of this year by the State Commission on Judicial Performance. He narrowly kept his seat after 4 of the 10 commissioners voted to actually remove him, including all of the 3 sitting judges on that panel. So that's pretty serious stuff. The commission found that Judge Kriep engaged in 29 acts of judicial misconduct between 2012 and 2015. The commission's vice chairman, Richard Simpson, wrote, "Judge Kriep has engaged in a pattern of misconduct that demonstrates lack of judicial temperament." He added that during Judge Kriep's campaign, he, quote, "created an appearance of lack of impartiality and also disregarded election laws and assuring accuracy of representations that he made to the public." After he took office, Simpson says Judge Kriep, quote, "often ran his courtroom in a manner that was undignified and suggested bias or prejudgment." Now, during his election in 2012, Kriep violated judicial rules against candidates being involved in politics. Judicial candidates are forbidden from doing that. But he was raising money to oppose President Obama's campaign. He was vocal in challenging Obama's birth certificate legitimacy. And, of course, we all know that allegation has been proven false after the state of Hawaii made that birth certificate public. After he was elected to the bench, he made inappropriate comments to those in the courtroom, including derogatory remarks about people's ethnicity, remarks about women attorneys' appearances. He would call attorneys nicknames such as Bunhead, Shorty, and Ms. Dimple. So I presume you're not going to be using nicknames when you get on the bench?
I don't plan to, unless that's a nickname that that the person has requested to be known by.
He also asked a prostitute whether she did it for the money or the action. He called an adult man a little boy, and he spoke Spanish to litigants based solely on their last names. And when the city attorney's office instituted a blanket challenge to basically boycott his courtroom, he was reassigned for a while to traffic court and then expressed hostility to the challenge, which led the commission to find he also committed willful misconduct, an even worse charge basically than he faced up till then. Now, he's since been reassigned to handle mostly landlord-tenant cases, I understand, and the commission has credited him for working hard at that venue and trying to heed the commission's admonitions. But it begs the obvious question. Tim, what would you say to voters who may be concerned about these scandals involving Judge Kriep, and how would you strive to avoid violations of judicial standards and, assure the public trust?
Well, I don't think it should be that hard for a judge to conduct himself in a manner that is ethical and that inspires confidence in the fairness of his decisions and of proceedings in his courtroom. Certainly, I would make sure that I would conduct myself in a way that litigants would know that whatever their background, they're going to be listened to, they're going to get a fair shake, and decisions are going to be made based on the evidence in the case and not based on other factors or biases. I think that's the most important prerequisite for being a good judge.
Yeah, I think most folks would agree with that. What compelled you to run for the judiciary? You've held all kinds of different offices out there. Why this one?
Well, I think that my background has prepared me especially well to be a judge, frankly. I've had the experience, as you mentioned, of being in criminal law, in civil law, and in family law, three major different areas of practice at a fairly high level. I've also had the experience of being a public official, first as a city councilman and then as a mayor in Chula Vista, our second largest city, very mm-hmm. diverse city, very fast growing city. And more recently, as a member of the board of the Southwestern Community College District, a district which at the time I was elected had some very serious challenges. In fact, we had several members of our administration who preceded my time on the board ended up pleading guilty to criminal charges.
so you came into another
So I helped oversee the cleanup, basically. And I think we've been largely successful at doing that. But also that experience in the last 7 years has added to the breadth of my knowledge of our communities in this region, of the needs of the region, and of how our communities and our legal system interact. I think that that's really an almost unique set of qualifications to be a judge.
It really is. It's very unusual. I've interviewed other judicial candidates, and usually their background is entirely or almost entirely in the legal field, not public service or the nonprofit arena or education. I would imagine that that also brings you into contact with people from all walks of life and maybe a little bit more understanding of where other people are coming from.
I would hope so. I certainly felt that as a public official, as mayor, or as a community college board member, that it was my duty to work in the interest of all of our citizens. We have a very diverse community in the South Bay, diverse in terms of cultural background and diverse in terms of professional backgrounds and economic backgrounds. And I think I've done fairly well with working with a lot of different people during those years. And I think that experience would be a real asset on the bench.
Now, listeners, if you just tuned in, we're speaking with Tim Nader, who is a candidate running for the Superior Court in San Diego. Now, listeners, you may not be aware, but the judicial canons of ethics prevent judicial candidates from talking about a lot of things that voters want to hear. They're not allowed to talk about their views, for instance, on issues that might come before them. So we can't ask him about his views on, say, gun control or abortion or all those controversies. But we do have some general questions to help give voters some insights and information, many of them courtesy of the League of Women Voters. So, Tim, when you worked for the Attorney General's office for so many years up there, both on the criminal and the civil side, as mentioned, what are some of the key cases that you've prosecuted or types of cases?
So way back when I was doing criminal cases for the Attorney General, I could talk about a couple of the cases I had. It was mostly felony appeals. I did some trial work as well. But a couple of the cases that come to mind as ones that I think were among the most interesting. One dealt with victim restitution. It was a felony hit and run. The victim survived, but was very badly injured. She was on a bicycle and a drunk driver plowed into her. The drunk driver left the scene of the accident and pled guilty to leaving the scene of the accident, but was ordered to make restitution to the victim and appealed that on the grounds that the victim's injuries were not caused by his leaving the scene and so that there wasn't an adequate connection. And we were successful in getting a ruling that because one of the purposes, he was actually given probation with restitution as a condition.
Goodness.
So because one of the purposes of probation, one of the other conditions, by the way, I believe was a year in jail. He didn't get off scot-free by any means. But one of the purposes of probation is the rehabilitation of the criminal.
True.
And so we successfully argued that requiring him to pay restitution to his victim would help rehabilitate him and therefore was relevant to making him learn to take responsibility for his actions. Another case that I was involved in was a gang-related murder in Orange County, in which three armed gang members confronted a member of a rival gang. Somebody fatally shot the victim. And each of the three accused suspects claimed that although they knew that there were firearms and that they knew that the purpose of going out of their way was to confront the victim, that I wasn't the one who pulled the trigger. It was one of the other two. That was what each of the three said.
Yeah, and obviously at least one of them had to be lying.
We were able to get a ruling that they were all three guilty of murder because all three had been involved in the conspiracy to, you know, as gang members to confront this individual who was killed, and they were all aware of the high likelihood that he would be killed.
And were those precedent-setting cases?
Yeah, both of those were published opinions in out of the Court of Appeals, so they serve as precedent. They're still on the books.
Very important. Now, as a school board president and a former mayor, what are some of the actions as an elected official that you've taken through the years that you are most proud of?
Well, going back to when I was mayor of Chula Vista, and that is going back a ways now, one of the things I was most proud of was the approach we took to public safety. You know, sometimes there has been in our political discourse, I think, a debate between are you tough on crime or do you focus on prevention and on addressing the social issues that maybe are causes of crime.
Correct.
I don't believe in that debate. I don't believe that it's either or. I think you need to do both. And so I was very proud of what we achieved in Chula Vista during those years. We significantly increased the size of our police force. I think we made it very clear to our police that we backed them up. We wanted to give them the best equipment we could afford. I took pride in listening to the frontline officers and what their concerns and needs were. We really beefed up the police presence on the streets of Chula Vista during those years. At the same time, we engaged in some new and innovative programs to work with at-risk youth, including a midnight basketball league with the police, a police activities league for at-risk youth, programs in cooperation with the schools, a program in cooperation with one of our nonprofit organizations to teach entrepreneurial skills to at-risk youth so that they would have some skills to work with as they transitioned into adulthood.
And how did that work out? Did you see a decrease in crime as a result?
We did. Chula Vista had one of the biggest decreases of crime in the year following the completion of my term. And I won't single-handedly take credit for all of that. But I think that the approach we took of combining a tough law enforcement approach with paying some attention to some of the social factors that contribute to risk of crime, that combination, I think, really did have some results.
Very good. I'd like to ask how you describe your general judicial philosophy.
Well, in general, I think, as I essentially said earlier, the most important thing for a judge is that people need to be confident that he's going to be fair, he's going to give everybody in his courtroom a fair shake, and he's going to listen to the facts, and he's going to decide the case based on evidence and not based on predispositions. Above and beyond that, it's important that people have confidence, and related to that people have confidence that a judge is applying the law and is not applying some personal predisposition to decide his cases.
Yeah, you know, we often hear terms like strict constructionist, judicial activist, living constitution when we're talking about judicial decisions. And just this week, President Trump's nominee for an appellate judicial nomination, Amy Comey Barrett, is quoted as saying, judges should be bound by their religious faith, not the law. What do you believe should guide you in making judicial decisions? And how do you balance that if, say, there was a case where your personal beliefs or your religious beliefs conflicted with state law or the Constitution?
Now, obviously, a judge's job is to apply the law. And the law in this country is that the United States Constitution is the supreme law of the land. That should always be the first guiding principle of any judge in the United States. In terms of what would happen, I'm a person of faith, and I don't see any conflict between applying the law and my faith as a Christian, which is what I am. I think that there have been countries and there have been times in history where there would have been such a conflict. Apartheid South Africa, Nazi Germany, places like that,
yeah,
where the Soviet Union, where there certainly would have been a serious conflict between faith and law. And perhaps if I was in one of those sorts of undemocratic situations, I might feel morally compelled to apply my faith rather than the law. But that's not the situation we have in the United States. We have a democratic society, and we have a constitution which includes a 14th Amendment, which basically guarantees that all laws must be just. 14th Amendment says all people are entitled to equal protection under the law. So an unjust law almost certainly is going to be an unconstitutional law, and therefore not a law that a judge should be applying anyway, if he's following the U.S. Constitution, which I think is clearly the highest obligation of a judge. Hypothetically, if a judge is in a situation where he or she really feels that there is a moral conflict between their deeply held religious or other moral beliefs and the law, they can recuse themselves and let another judge who doesn't have that conflict come in and decide the case and apply the law, because it is a judge's job to apply the law. If you feel you can't do that in a particular case, you should not be sitting on that case.
Very good point. Now, as a public official, have you had to recuse yourself before when there were situations where there maybe was a financial conflict of interest or an ethical conflict of interest or a work-related conflict of interest?
Yeah, I've never had a financial conflict of interest. I have recused myself in situations where I was concerned that there might be just the appearance of dual loyalties with my full-time employment, because I do work as a deputy attorney general for the state. For example, where a board I was sitting on was considering requesting an opinion from the attorney general, I would recuse myself from a situation like that. I would recuse myself in a situation where there's an open question as to the interpretation of the law, and I know the Attorney General is taking a particular position that may or may not be consistent with the interests of the board that I serve on. So yeah. In those situations, I do recuse myself. They're pretty rare.
All right. Our new district attorney, Summer Steffen, has said that she wants to make prosecution of hate crimes a priority. We've certainly seen nationwide a rise in not only hate crimes, but hate-related speech and violence. How do you, as a judge, believe that the rights of free speech, even unpopular speech, should be balanced against the rights of people who might be harmed by speech that foments hatred or racism?
Well, speech that is pure speech, even if it is despicable, and even if I might strongly disagree with it on moral as well as other grounds, is protected by the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. Now, all of our rights are subject to the caveat that they are subject to the protection of everybody else's rights as well.
Right. You can't yell fire in a crowded theater.
The classic example. So, you know, I think there has to be a distinction drawn between hate speech and hate crime. Not all hate speech is going to be criminal. Somebody can express some very despicable views or demonstrate in support of some very despicable ideas, and be within their rights under the First Amendment of the United States Constitution. Mm-hmm. When they step over the line and begin threatening the safety of others, then you move from the realm of hate speech to hate crime.
Right. What about that gray area where they may be encouraging others? I'm thinking there was a civil case that was won against Tom Metzger. When he was, in a sense, advocating violence, and one or more of his followers went out and killed somebody, and there was a civil suit that held him responsible for that, and he basically, you know, lost much of his fortune because of that.
That's correct. And there's an important distinction between a civil and a criminal case. In the case you're talking about, Mr. Metzger was not held criminally responsible, but he was held civilly responsible because his actions caused death, I believe, I remember correctly, to an innocent person. And that person's family was able to sue him essentially for wrongful death.
Yeah, a young black man that was killed.
Right. It's a tenet of our system that one can be held civilly responsible for one's actions, even if those actions are not in themselves criminal. Secondly, there are criminal laws dealing with things like solicitation of crime or incitement to crime. And so that can be a bit of a gray area, but certainly if somebody is instructing another person to commit a crime, is giving strong encouragement to committing criminal activity or violence, that moves into the realm of yelling fire in the crowded theater, where it becomes more than just an expressing an opinion, which is protected by the First Amendment. It becomes an incitement to criminal activity, which is no longer protected.
Okay. Youth violence is on the rise. Some would say there's a crisis of this. Is there an appropriate role for the judiciary in attempting to address this problem?
I think there is. I think, first of all, you know, and I know we've had judges in our juvenile courts who have really tried to provide some alternatives to traditional law enforcement and to pay attention to the social and educational needs of some of the young people who come before them. And those approaches can really turn lives around. In the judiciary, it tends to be one case at a time, okay? The judges are not legislators. They're not going to mandate entire programs or
right.
entire approaches, but they do have discretion in the cases that come before them as to how they handle those cases. And so I think, particularly in the juvenile courts, we can look at on a case-by-case basis at what will it take to turn a young life around and turn them from a life of violence and crime toward a life of productivity and good citizenship. Secondly, there are other factors, I think, that are involved in that rise in youth violence that you're talking about that judges in other courts may want to be cognizant of when exercising their discretion. There's no question in my mind that the prevalence of drug use is a factor in youth neglect, which in turn leads to youth violence, for example. And so that is something to take into account when one is looking at a case where somebody's criminal activity may be causing some of these other social impacts.
So maybe a rehab program might be
appropriate. A rehab program might be appropriate if you're talking about a user. A lengthy prison commitment might be appropriate if you're talking about somebody who is going out there and marketing these substances to a large number of other people.
Yeah, exactly. Human traffickers, some of these folks.
Right.
What do you perceive to be the greatest obstacle or obstacles to justice in our justice system today?
Well, on the civil side, I think clearly disparities in wealth and the effect that wealth or lack of it can have on access to legal resources and justice is
yeah.
obviously a problem. I can't say I have a magic answer for it. As a judge, I would certainly listen to everybody fairly and equally. But there's no question that both a knowledge gap and a wealth gap among our citizenry leads to a gap in access to justice very much on the civil side.
Yeah.
On the criminal side, I think that's a little less pronounced because we do have institutions like the public defender and
Correct.
Constitutional guarantees of at least representation by counsel. But nonetheless, it's a fact that not everybody, due to wealth differences, is going to have access to the same number or even quality of lawyers.
Yeah. What would you do if you observed a party in your courtroom that was represented by a lawyer who was just unprepared or ineffective or maybe not familiar with the type of law, the type of case they were handling?
If it was a criminal case so that that person's due process rights are implicated, I would probably take a break from the proceedings. And if this was somebody who worked for another law office, perhaps take them aside, talk to them about the possibility that maybe they need to bring in a more senior associate or
yeah.
somebody with experience in that area to protect their client's constitutional rights. In a civil matter, that I think gets a little trickier because the litigant has the right to choose their lawyer, and I don't think the judge should be interfering with a lawyer-client relationship. So, you know, perhaps a sidebar conference where there's a discreet inquiry as to what is taking place here. And that's really a fact-intensive case-by-case sort of inquiry
Sure.
that I couldn't possibly say ahead of time.
Okay.
How I would handle it, but I would, you know, certainly want to make sure that people's constitutional rights are protected.
Obviously, protecting public safety is a paramount responsibility for a judge. And on the other hand, the U.S. has more people behind bars than any developed country in the world, and a very high rate of those are minorities. What do you believe are the causes of those high rates of incarceration of minorities or the high rate of incarceration overall? What's broken with our system that we seem to have these problems that other countries don't?
I think there are several factors, and I think you raise two issues that are often conflated in the public discourse, but I think they are somewhat distinct issues. One is mm-hmm. the high overall rates of incarceration. The other is the disproportionate amount of minority incarceration.
Yeah.
The high overall rates of incarceration, quite frankly, we have more crime than many other, as you put it, civilized nations in the world. And why we have more crime is probably a very complicated question that
yeah.
would be beyond my ability to give a definitive answer to. But certainly in my observation from the years I was in criminal prosecution was that one of the factors is the prevalence of hard illicit drugs, of
yeah.
Especially drugs like methamphetamine, which without question cause a whole lot of the other crime we have. I can tell you that when I was a prosecutor, 80% of my caseload would have disappeared had there not been such prevalence of, you know, and I'm not talking about someone who smokes a joint recreationally. I'm talking about meth addicts, and cocaine addicts.
Yeah, so that's, because it leads to burglaries. It leads to burglaries.
It leads to violent crime because people lose, I think some of these drugs cause people to lose that self-control that distinguishes most of us from other animals.
Yeah.
And so it leads to a lot of other problems. But that's a distinct issue from why there is such a disproportionate number of minorities who are incarcerated, because my experience was that minorities are not committing a disproportionate number of the crimes, but they're getting a disproportionate amount of the sentencing. You know, that suggests at some level, or perhaps at multiple levels, some bias in the system. Do I think our system in California is overtly racist? No, I don't. But do I think that clearly there is some perhaps unconscious bias taking place that is leading to an unacceptable result? Yes, clearly that's happening. Case in point, the majority of marijuana users are white. The majority of marijuana arrestees are African American.
Interesting.
There's a discrepancy there, right? And I'm not saying, I mean, the people of California have voted to legalize recreational marijuana, so that particular crime may go away. But I think it illustrates a deeper issue.
Yeah, definitely. Given your opponent, Judge Creep's background, and listeners, for those that tuned in late today, Judge Creep, just last month, August, was found by the State Commission on Judicial Performance to have engaged in 29 acts of judicial misconduct over a 3-year period. That's pretty substantial. So it begs the question, do you believe the current system of disciplining lawyers and judges is effective? Why or why not? I mean, he had 29 violations, but he is still on the bench by a narrow vote.
Well, as you say, it was a narrow vote. And as you pointed out earlier, every one of the sitting judges on that commission voted to remove him for that misconduct. So I don't, although I might not personally agree with the decision of the majority of the commission.
Yeah, and I don't want to make it just about Judge Creep.
That's
but I guess
right.
The broader question, maybe this one's an anomaly, but the broader question is are the standards tough enough?
And broadly speaking, I think the standards are very good, actually. In the case you're talking about, it was found that there was a violation of the standards. That was not even an issue. You know, I've been aware of other situations where lawyers and judges have been accused of ethical violations and have been disciplined. And my sense is that the standards are good and that generally the system works fairly well. Probably the biggest flaw with the system that I see is the time it takes for cases to work their way through that system. So you do have the potential for a practicing lawyer or judge to, if they are not determined to mend their ways, to continue causing harm or undermining public confidence while the case is pending. But I think the standards themselves and the people who apply them have, on the whole, done a pretty good job.
Well, that's good. That's reassuring. Another problem facing our court system in California is that the system has really been suffering from severe funding cuts at the state level. You know, so extreme that many cases are very, very backlogged. They've cut a lot of the court services here in East County. There's things you used to be able to get handled out here, and now if you live in Campo or somewhere, you may have to drive an hour into the city of San Diego to have your case heard or even pick up documents. They've even eliminated court reporters for certain kinds of cases, mm-hmm. which I found pretty shocking. So the question I have is, do you have any ideas on how to improve efficiencies in the court system without harming the rights of litigants or defendants? And what are your thoughts about these funding levels?
So as a member of a community college board during the same time frame in which these cuts have occurred, I'm acutely aware of the state's recent financial difficulties, and of the fact that it has put state officials in the very uncomfortable position of having to choose among competing priorities, education, justice, parks and recreation services, public safety services. You know, all of these are important. And
yeah, it's got to be tough to be a legislator and have to choose.
It's very tough. I think our current governor has done an outstanding job, frankly, of turning the state around and improving our state's budgetary picture. But nonetheless, the fact is that resources are limited, and that's a fact of life in California as elsewhere. I think, you know, you mentioned the cutbacks in court reporting services. I work in civil law now, and yes, I find it to be very inconvenient to have to arrange my own court reporter for a hearing.
Wow.
There's no question about it. But compared to the inconvenience that might be caused, for example, if somebody from East County or South County has to go to North County to get their case heard. You know, these are the kinds of competing priorities that have to be weighed when implementing budget cuts. And I would honestly, with all respect to my colleagues in the legal profession, if I had to choose between inconveniencing the lawyers and inconveniencing the litigants, I would go with the notion that the lawyers probably know their way around the system a little more easily.
Very good point. What is your vision for the future of our judicial system overall? Do you have any changes that you would advocate for that we haven't already talked about today?
I don't know that I would advocate changes in the system itself. I think no system of human beings is going to be perfect because we humans are inherently imperfect. But I think on the whole, the American justice system is probably as good as it gets. I think that if we have judges who scrupulously follow the United States Constitution, who believe in upholding the rule of law, and who believe in judicial independence, that the system itself is designed to work about as well as a system can work. That said, I think I bring to what is already on the whole, I think, a very strong bench in San Diego, some assets in terms of my background in public service that I think will give me an awareness of some of our community and social issues and the interrelation between those issues and the law that will make me a better judge than I would be if I didn't have that background.
And listeners, if you just tuned in, we have been speaking with Tim Nader. You may know him as a former mayor of Chula Vista. He works with the State Attorney General's office currently. He's also president of the Southwest Community College Board, and he's now running for a position as Superior Court Judge in San Diego. Tim, I'm going to let you have the last word today. Why do you believe voters should support you instead of your opponent, Judge Creep?
First of all, I haven't formally become a candidate yet, although I expect I will be doing that soon. But what I bring to the bench is what every judge should be, first of all. I think people who have come before me in my quasi-judicial capacities in the past have found that I am fair, that I listen, that I deliver a fair hearing. I would certainly do that as a judge. I certainly know how to do that and have experience doing it. Judges should always listen to the evidence and decide the case on the evidence and the law. Judges should first and foremost uphold the United States Constitution, including the 14th Amendment, which guarantees equal protection to all. I believe strongly in that. And I believe I would be the kind of judge that the overwhelming majority of our citizens want and deserve.
Tim, I want to thank you very much for joining us today on the East County Magazine show on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice.
It's been a pleasure.
A work of art along the border in Tecate, visible from San Diego's East County, is drawing national attention. French artist J.R. has erected a 70-foot-high mural on the Mexican side of the border fence facing the United States. Titled Caquito, it depicts a 1-year-old boy smiling impishly and peeking over the border fence at all who pass by. The artist posted on Twitter, "The history of humanity is the story of people migrating." His mural draws attention to the plight of innocent children denied entry to the U.S. or facing expulsion under President Donald Trump's tough immigration policies. The work, which took a month to complete, has been reported on in the Washington Post, New York Times, Los Angeles Times, and other major media. It's also drawn crowds locally. Photos show passerby and Border Patrol agents gazing up at the beguiling boy as tall as a 7-story building. On Twitter, artist JR writes, "At 1 year old, you don't see the frontier or which side is better. For this kid, there are no walls or borders." The art installation comes as prototype of a solid border wall aimed at beefing up border security are set to be built in San Diego's Otay Mesa, with plans to ultimately obstruct the entire U.S. border. Trump has also stepped up detentions and deportations of undocumented immigrants, as well as announcing the end of the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, or DACA. So unless Congress takes action in 6 months, dreamers, brought here as children or infants, can soon be deported. J.R. hopes his artwork can change hearts and minds. He believes that views on immigration are all a matter of perspective, adding, "What you see can change who you are." His artwork is also drawing praise on Twitter, including a woman who called it beautiful and soul-inspiring, adding that the artwork rises above the wall in more ways than one. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Jonathan Goetz.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Liz Alper, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Royalty Free Music, Blues 3 Music, and Pond 5. We also thank the County of San Diego for a community enhancement grant to support our Destination East County segment. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.